You are tuned in to another edition of Americana Music Profiles, brought to you by Americana Rhythm Music Magazine and AmericanaMusicMagazine.com. I'm your host, Greg Tutwiler. Let's jump right in to the next exciting interview. Ed Roman is an award-winning singer-songwriter from Shelburne, Ontario, Canada. His music has been heard on more than 600 radio stations worldwide and was featured as a Billboard magazine emerging artist in December of 2018. His music blurs the lines between folk, country music, and even some pop and rock genres. His new single is Tomorrow's Today. Ed joins me today on this edition of Americana Music Profiles as we talk about his career and his new music. Hello, Ed. Welcome to the podcast.
Greg, it's good to be here on Americana Rhythm Magazine.
Glad to have you join us. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your Canadian afternoon to speak with us. Where are you specifically?
Ontario, Canada. So I'm north of Toronto by a couple hours in an old farming community called Melanchthon.
Okay. Awesome.
Yeah.
Has that always been home?
No, you know, I grew up in Markham. I was sort of born, bred, patched, raised, incubated, however you want to look at it, and made the transition up here about 14 years ago, just because I grew up in a rural farming community, and I like farming, and I still do it today, and this area offered me that, plus I got a lot of friends up in this neck of the woods. I played up here a lot. It's second highest elevation in Ontario.
Oh, wow.
Go on.
Yeah.
But it's just, it feels like home.
So the community that you are in, does that afford you opportunities to play, or do you have to travel back into Toronto and in that direction?
Yeah, I'm pretty much always traveling. I mean, what's fortunate is that there's been a lot of burgeoning pubs, public houses, restaurants, all over the area that have been popping up in the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So aside from traveling and going to TO, there's work up here, but with what's going on in terms of the globe, I mean, every musician I know is struggling, from people that are doing, or were doing, theater work to studio work to live performance. It's just crazy.
Yeah. So you guys are kind of pretty much locked down in the rural areas as well?
Yeah, we're considered gray. I don't know why they consider gray the worst of the band ratio, gray area. I don't know, red.
Okay. Right.
Not, but yeah, you can only have one person per family per store, and I can go on and on with the list. But yeah, we're locked down here.
Okay,
yeah.
Wow. Oh, I know you and the rest of us will be all glad when when all of that's behind us, whatever that looks like. I don't even know what that looks like anymore.
Well, I saw a picture of a combine harvester at night the other night, and I thought it was a live crowd in front of a stage, and I got excited.
Yeah, I've seen that floating around.
Have you seen that?
I have. That it is very deceiving. Whoever shot that, you know, it's funny how the mind will play tricks on you. Yeah, it does. It looks like a field full of people.
Yeah, it does. And there's like a stage and like some big event, lights and everything.
Yeah.
With the harvester.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So how long has music been? When did this start for you? When were you introduced into the idea of being able to play music?
Well, I tell you the truth, there's a problem more so than anything. I mean, I struggled immensely and still do with dyslexia.
Mm-hmm.
And academically, I was really suffering in so many ways. It's not that I didn't want to learn or I wasn't excited to learn, but at the same time, the academic framework expects you to keep up a certain pace with certain
sure.
things. So at a very young age, when, you know, the system had me tested and they want to put me on Ritalin, and my mom, God bless her soul, she was like, so a steadfast parent, always working, schoolwork with us, reading with us. But she was also clever enough to know that I gravitated to music. I was always singing, always wanted to play the old piano that was in the front hall of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always telling stories. So it was a breakaway thing for me because it liberated me from all that other,
okay.
you know, that was it. And I've been doing it ever since because I can relate. I can relate to people, the musicians.
Yeah.
It's three-dimensional. As a dyslexic, I've come to understand, as an ambassador for the whole dyslexic society here in Canada, that it's three-dimensional perception. it's not that it's a problem. Henry Winkler more recently defined it as a gift. I'm not saying we're better or worse than anybody else, but we crave that three-dimensional contact with our environment, and education to us so flat and linear as it is in terms of text, it doesn't jump off the page. A dyslexic's mind is out there trying to put things in three-dimensional format and words. That's the other aspect. So music doesn't have that. It has the sense of fluidity, storytelling, all the things that are three-dimensional. And I can go on and on and on about it, but I can't imagine doing anything else. I mean, right. Somebody asked me in an interview, if you weren't dyslexic, would you be doing it? And I'd be like, I think I'd still be pursuing music because I love it that much.
Yeah, wow. At what age were you able to grasp that, hey, this actually could be a career, and I could do this professionally?
We went out on the road as a young band. We were on Capitol Records' farm team. Dean Cameron had signed us to this deal, and we were, they were throwing some money our way. We were on the road with some bigger bands and opening for them, and then I sort of thought, hey, this isn't just a high school dream with buddies. Like, maybe there's something to this. And then I more seriously wanted to pursue it as an education, so that's why I went to college, and I wanted to study performance, because I was excited to be able to apply it in a lot of places, and I also knew it'd be work. Like, I made a lot of money as a cocktail musician, playing at weddings, everything we did, mostly jazz out of the American Songbook standard books.
Okay.
But at the same time, it still gave me that other envelope of songwriting, experience, exposure. But, at a very young age, at the same time, it's like, still, I think I was wanting to do this. Like, even the people when I was younger, like, what do you want to do? It was like, I either want to go into, like, something theatrical music or, like, archaeology. I love history and stuff that. So that's why I guess storytelling hand in hand with, in terms of anthropology and sociology, go hand in hand with me again.
So this has been... You've truly been able to do this as a professional career your whole life then?
Yeah, well, I mean, I taught as well for like a lot of musicians I know for almost 24 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that also was part of supplementing my income. But I mean, one year we made 40 grand playing rep brunches at this golf club.
Yeah.
Like, there was always some way to make cash.
Yeah.
Because you had that ability to diversify
right.
in terms of who you were as a person. And that's what I like a lot of the musicians that I play with. They have this huge gambit of enthusiasm when it comes to such a variety of music. So I think that's the key to stay alive in any industry, is to
sure.
be able to diversify, right?
Right, yeah. Who were some of your early influences musically?
Well, you know what? I remember, a lot of 50s music, because that, like, in my house, between my grandparents listening to, like, old Eastern European, like, gypsy music.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
But then huge, huge influences as far as, like, my grandmother loved, like, Sinatra and the Beatles and then my brothers and sisters were far older than I was, coming out of the 60s. So I was influenced by all the 70s music, everything from, like, Deep Purple to Elton John to, Black Sabbath.
Yeah,
to, like,
okay.
like, all over the place. Like, in Grateful Dead, there was no holds barred, it seemed like, when people were listening to music, because there was almost a fight for the record player
right.
or what was on the radio station, because we only had one record player and a radio in the kitchen.
Yeah.
But that all those, it was other people's enthusiasm, but I remember I was 12, and the ABC movie was like Woodstock.
Oh, wow, okay.
And I remember watching, I was like, I wasn't supposed to watch it, snuck downstairs, turned on the TV, and the first thing I saw was Hendrix playing Star Spangled Banner.
Oh, man.
And I just went, what the?
Yeah.
Because I was experiencing these tight formula, arrangements. I mean, I'd heard some Deep Purple and stuff, but Hendrix, I then almost devoutly followed, like, other artists, like Hendrix. Jaco Pastorius was another guy, like, when I was much younger, somebody handed me a bunch of Jaco records and said, well, if you're going to start playing bass, you should listen to this guy.
Uh-huh.
Mingus was a huge influence to me, because when I went to college, I was really interested in composition. everybody, Bob Marley, Dylan, I mean, I could go on and on, but it was weird because even the Tower of Power, for like a year and a half, 2 years, I did nothing but listen to Tower of Power.
Huh, that's cool.
Like studying them like they were some kind of like university degree. Everything about them, the history of the band. So, I mean, I come from a lot of funk, rock, R&B, soul, and storytelling folk kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a whole blend of everything in the weirdest of ways. I try not to think about it too much, to tell you the truth.
Well, I think that's the difference between a musician and somebody who plays music. Because a musician has to have, either currently or continuously, but has to have taken that journey, whatever that looks like for them, what you did, into studying and examining other musicians and consuming. I think you miss something if you don't live that way.
Yeah. Like, I mean, and that's the other thing too, regurgitation, like, that's cool. Like, I've learned so many other people's numbers and licks and lyrics.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't want to be those people. I've heard some really interesting and potent statements from people like, well, it's fine. We're all defined by our influences, but at the same time, they can be our limitations.
Sure, yeah.
Allowing that to be in the background. Carlos Santana even does the same stuff. He calls it casting. So he'll go up into the studio and play for a while. He's casting out, you know, he'll play some, like, John Coltrane, or he'll play something that's like he's really, and then all of a sudden it starts to leave, and that him starts to come to the forefront.
Yeah.
He spends more of the time following those catalysts of ideas that then become his own, because they're part of his own artistic amusement and realization through construction.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the other hard part of it. Sometimes I listen to something and I go, well, that kind of sounds like, it reminds me, it's okay.
Yeah.
That's fine to have that, but how do you want to present it in a way that makes it comfortable to you is what actually makes it comfortable to the listener.
We're going to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the interview.
I like hearing people's originality, but it's also fun to hear influences sneak in. I was listening to your song "I Am Love," and I could just hear little bits and pieces of what felt like the Talking Heads, just kind of sneak in the way that you were presenting some of the lyrics. I thought that's really cool. I just like the way that kind of just kind of sneaks through there, and you don't even really realize it. I just happen to have been listening to them lately and go, you know, I can kind of hear that coming through. So it was really cool.
Oh, dude, you know what? And like David Byrne and like, I love, like, that's like some of that, like Once in a Lifetime is a desert album song.
Yeah.
Definitely for me. And like almost 90% of the musicians that I know will have that song in their list.
Yeah.
As far as, that's such a compliment to me, because I love the artistic approach of that band.
Yeah.
And that tune specifically is like, it's got that really cool bass line that's just almost repeating itself and flipping on itself. It's so neat.
Yeah, and your lyrical presentation, it kind of reminded me of that song, Once in a Lifetime. It wasn't a copy, but it was just, I could hear that float through there, and it was cool. It was like,
thank you so much. That's such a big compliment for me. Yeah. You made my month.
Okay, good. Well, yeah, I sometimes I hesitate to do that because I know people don't want to be compared to, but I heard it. I could hear the influences, and I'm glad that it landed the right way.
Well, you didn't say Pat Boone, so I'm good with it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I don't think we want that comparison today.
Sorry, Pat, I love you, though.
Yeah. So you have been, how long has this been kind of, so you've got a new album out. I don't want to neglect that. You're promoting a new single. How long has this been the approach for your career as a solo musician?
Well, you know, it's funny, like, I'm always writing, and I'm always, I love bouncing ideas off of other people. I love letting ideas sit in escrow for a little while, because sometimes they need a little time to mature.
Mm-hmm.
And with that said, as a solo artist, I mean, having a full-on band before, there's politics, there's a lot of other things that you know, require different methodology in terms of the approach. But the other thing is, like, I've always kept a very open table, even when I was bringing a lot of material, all the material, to other band projects in terms of lyrical content and arrangement. I was never negated the idea of trying something in a completely different way, other right. chord structures, whatever it was. So that's what I loved about the that input from other people, is that there were like no egos. It's just like, how, what does the song require mm-hmm. as it's sort of unfolding in the process? The same thing has happened to me as a solo artist, where I'm like, over the last year, I've been grouping a whole bunch of material. This stuff feels like it belongs together, and in the weirdest of ways, it's fitting under this title, you know. And we've changed so much in terms of the approach to how people acquire music, right, what they right. want. You know, I mean, if, when I was teaching, you know, people were going to work on something and I wanted to look at their music files or whatever, there'd be an album, but there'd be only two tunes from that album.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to the whole album. And I came from that experience. Well, if you bought the CD or vinyl, you know, you may have fell in love with the A or B single because you heard it on the radio, but
right.
other tracks start to filter their way in that sort of really help with that umbrella of why the album is what it is.
Right.
And as a solo artist, because as things have changed, I realized, well, what? It's a singles market. Like,
yeah.
there's nothing wrong with releasing a single, waiting a couple months, putting out a vignette maybe with it, or a vignette when it comes out. It doesn't really matter, provided that you're continually sort of pumping stuff out into the equation. And
right.
then in a year's time, come to the point where it's like, okay, well, four or five of these are out, let's put out an album.
Yeah.
And press it and go from there. But it becomes a great testing ground for me as well, too, to find out, well, this tune is very different than the previous number that I released. Tomorrow Is Today is very different and stronger. But at the same time, I'm like, well, okay, that's good. And however it sticks and however people want to use it, I'm good with it. I just
yeah.
want to keep creating.
Yeah.
So it doesn't change that much for me other than this environment, which makes it hard to play live as a band
right.
or a solo artist,
yeah.
whatever it is. That has completely changed that cosmetic. And playing live streaming events is great, but it's very different than a live show.
Of course, yeah. It's missing that three-dimensional element. And I miss that so much.
Yeah, me too, Greg.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure you guys miss it more than I do. But, yeah, it's, oh, man.
We all need it. We all need it.
Yeah.
Communal. It's like the town hall meeting, you know, in the cathedral of music, if you will. It's like, it's so cathartic for people getting together to talk, expel their daily woes before
sure.
the show, after talk, laugh, have fun, eat
yeah.
some food, whatever it is. It's so cultural.
Yeah.
And having it not there all of a sudden after, it's just like, what?
And it feels like when you, the live streaming, apparatus, you miss the energy that goes on between artist and audience. Whether it's a big audience or small audience, you miss the eye contact, you miss the, you know, seeing the sweat on the artist's brow, you miss seeing the artist cringe or laugh. You know, it's that energy is a vital element of the playing and the consuming.
Absolutely. Like, and you know, I mean, the other thing is too, is like, I don't have a problem doing it. Like, I welcome it even before the idea of all this happening. I mean, I think it's not a bad thing. I was doing an event a couple months back, and all of a sudden I've got 830 people watching.
Mm-hmm.
By the time they had done their repost and what have you, it went up to 16,000 people.
Yeah,
so
that's awesome.
That 45-minute set that I may have done in Toronto or up here or wherever I was playing may have had 50 to 120 people
right,
in it.
Right.
So
yeah.
where do I weigh the difference? Because I know exposure is extremely important.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But then the compensation is the other side of it. So.
Right, yeah. I feel like when we go back, there'll be a hybrid. You know, you go do the 50-seat pub, but you live stream it or you record it and post it later, you know? And so you kind of get the best of both worlds, I hope. I hope that we find a way to make good.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, people were already doing it in so many ways, whether they were streaming from their phone or clubs were doing it. It's a good thing. Like, I mean, it just sort of keeps the circle going in a different way.
Right.
And so, like I said, I welcome it, but it's so important to have a live show. I mean,
yeah.
I like talking to people. I like being with people, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, Right. Yeah, I enjoy consuming it with people. You know, you feed on their energy and likes of the music and applause and all of that kind of emotion that goes along with it.
Or in the moment too, right?
That's right.
The way the things unfold. Yeah. It's an improvisational existence, so anything can happen other than what you may have planned.
Yeah.
Sometimes that doesn't always work out.
Right. Yeah. So you have then released how many singles of this stretch that you're in?
Second single came out on November 16th. We're pushing close to 10,000 views right now. It's got a lot of wonderful reviews from magazines and bloggers. It's got a video vignette that goes with it that people can watch. It's on YouTube, and it's for sale, like Stronger, same thing. Stronger's out there. It's got a lyric video connected to it. But, again, it's like I could release something tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've come to understand about the more of the business side of where we sit today is that there's so much information coming out of
it. Oh, yeah, yeah.
On a regular basis. Like, whether we go to the old antiquated systems of the TV or we're flipping through our iPad or our phone or we're it's incredible the amount of information. I think it behooves most artists to just hold your reins a bit and jump in every once in a while, because those things I've noticed are sort of those sort of liberating pockmarks of happiness.
Yeah.
That, so that they come too frequently, you know, it's like getting, you know, too much of what you want all the time.
Yeah.
Or again, it gets lost in the menagerie of information just
sure.
because there's so much out there all the time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and if you dump it all at once, most people aren't going to sit down for 35 or 40 minutes and listen to an album all the way through anymore. Our attention span to do that is gone. So if you're giving them a bite at a time, then they're always kind of looking for the next bite. And then you compile them together at the end and say, here's the whole pie. And you're kind of doing
right.
it backwards. So, yeah.
Right. And that's what, I mean, it's like the yesteryear, I mean, singles, people were cutting four
right,
boxes,
exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah.
The record album came to the idea that there was more available space at a different revolutions per minute.
Yeah.
And we could start incorporating these. Before that, even the books. I've got some of the books of the 78s and stuff. So that booklet, even though they're only a song per side,
yeah.
makes the album, because it's like a photo album, but
yeah.
it's a record album, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing just to hold your reins a bit and
yeah.
have fun with it.
Yeah,
way,
right.
right.
Everything that's old will be new again. It just
yeah.
it comes back around one way or the other. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to tell us about your music and your story and how you got to where you are, and certainly appreciate you sharing a little bit about your cause and your journey with dyslexia. I know that's a thing that people are finally discovering and realizing that that there's ways to embrace that and live with it. So I certainly applaud you for keeping the support for that, and wish you the best with the rest of your music as it comes out too.
You know what, Greg? I really appreciate that because, we do a lot of stuff, man, sometimes in our lives. And the weirdest thing about this experience for me with the whole dyslexic society is I'm going to give all this away. It's a story about my own personal struggle in my life. I'm lucky I found somebody that was a great animator who had tenure that helped me create a video. The Dyslexic Society embraced it. It's helping raise money and awareness. It's bigger than me. And I feel so lucky that I had that weird sense of feeling like I'm just going to give it all. Because it's like, it's such a spiritually solidifying thing without there being any dogma attached.
Yeah, yeah.
I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks. What's the best way for people to... if they want to talk to you about that and they want to hear the new music or maybe get in touch with some of your older catalog, how's the best way to reach you?
EdRoman.net, the website. Social networking buttons are there. Twitter, Instagram, YouTube channel, my Facebook. Everywhere you're going to find me is Special Ed Roman. Obviously, my management is MPS Management. That's Michael Stover. He's down in Apollo, PA. All the new albums are all out on iTunes, Amazon. You can get stuff, physical copies through CD Baby. You can listen to older stuff on SoundCloud at Special Ed Roman. there's a lot of stuff to filter through.
Yeah. Well, I applaud you for your career, and I appreciate the time to talk with you today about all of this. Thanks, Ed.
You too, man, and I appreciate Americana Rhythm Magazine giving me the opportunity, man.
Thanks again for tuning in to this episode of Americana Music Profiles. Find us on iTunes at Americana Music Profiles and on the internet at AmericanaRhythm.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.